Larry, let's start with what has happened to Donald Trump. How did you find this shooting?
Not a surprise. I'll make a very philosophic comment here. Joe Biden and his remarks just appalled me. I mean, what planet is President Biden living on? And yet, when I ask that question, I understand the phenomenon because I've had to live with it myself, especially and vividly the last 20 years. He said, and I wrote this down, we must. No, we cannot and must not go down this road in America. We cannot and must not go down this road in America, referring to violence, political violence or otherwise. What planet is he living on? There are 494 million guns in this country. We killed 43 million people with those guns last year, probably equal that this year. We have a shooting almost daily. In America, we have a mass shooting almost weekly, certainly monthly. We have more political violence overseas that we are instrumental in, if not the cause of, Ukraine and Gaza standing out most violently, brutally, and cruelly. We're perpetrating those conflicts. Oh, those are brown people. Oh, those are Ukrainians. That doesn't count. I guess that's what they say to themselves. And when I say they, I mean Blinken and Sullivan and Biden and Austin and the Congress of the United States, almost to a man, to a woman. We live in one of the most politically violent countries ever in the history of the world, and certainly in the modern age. And the president gets up there and says, we must not go down this road. Mr. President, we've been on this road for a long time. Arguably, since World War II, and most definitely and brutally since 9/11. This violence is America's middle name. You can imagine how you feel realizing that and living in a country where your president gets up and says, we must not go down this road.
How this shooting at Donald Trump would help him in 2024, in your opinion?
Well, we discussed that. My daughter and my daughter's husband are both Secret Service agents. They are were. They got out of the Secret Service for a number of reasons, some of which are very apparent now in the Secret Service. But they first commented on, as did several other friends of mine who are retired Secret Service agents, both plain clothes and uniform, protective detail and other things like counterfeiting. They first commented on the rather inept performance of the Secret Service around him. Their main comment being, they should have gotten him out of there. You basically have about 1.5 seconds. That's all talking about ballistics and other things. 1.5. If you go back and you look at Ronald Reagan when he was shot, and you see what Ray Shattuck and that detail did, which many Secret Service agents, especially veterans, will tell you was the last time the Secret Service was any good. They pushed him into that car. They got him out of the shooter's eyes and range and got him out of there to the hospital. Well, they just encased him. Well, that isn't going to do a whole lot of good if the guy's got an automatic weapon, a semi-automatic weapon, and he's shooting a lot of rounds up there. You're going to get Secret Service agents killed, and your target's probably going to get killed too. Your protectee's probably going to get killed too. So off the stage immediately. None of this hovering up there and checking the ear and all that kind of stuff off the stage immediately. Not all that professional. I don't know about the shooting of the bystanders. I haven't heard explicitly and precisely how that occurred. And I don't know how that guy got up on that building without you always case the joint, as it were. And when you case the joint, you go out to rifle range. You go out to even AR-15 range, which isn't that long when you're talking about accuracy. But if you're going out to Model 70 Winchester range, which is the assassin weapon of choice in my book, you go out a long way. You go out a half a mile and you really look on roofs, in gutters, in drains. You look everywhere. Did they do that? Did they prep that way? Because otherwise, it seems like the photos I've seen, you would have seen that guy lying up there on that building, or you would have had some indication that someone was somewhere they shouldn't be. So there were a lot of things about it that looked like tradecraft was not that good. Secret Service tradecraft, protective detail, tradecraft was not that good. And then to your question, Look what it did for Reagan. There are many people, political types that I knew around Colin Powell, who were old school Republicans, who said that saved Ronald Reagan's presidency because he was looking bad at that point. He got shot. He became a hero because he weathered it so well, so courageously, bravely, you know, kind of brushed it off. And yet he was pretty badly hit. Ray Shattuck told me he was pretty badly hit. So that resurrected his presidency in many respects. What does that lead you to believe? Well, a lot of people, not a lot of people, but some people on the usual places are talking about staged, talking about, you know, this was all set up and that's the reason they killed the guy who shot him. Didn't want him to talk, like Jack Ruby with regard to Kennedy's assassination in 63. And I'm convinced that's true. That's true. They started killing people right away because they did not want, they were former government and current government officials in the military and the CIA and perhaps elsewhere. They killed Jack Kennedy. They put it all together and they killed Jack Kennedy. I'm convinced of that now after looking at all the data and going over the Warren report, which is a farce, an absolute farce. How they got that report to be accepted is a study in psychology, because you actually had people like institutions, magazines like The Nation, a very leftist periodical, and Noam Chomsky accepting the Warren Commission report. And on the other side, you got the right wingers accepting the commission report and everybody in between. A psychoanalysis of that would probably tell you that it was such a shock to the fiber of the country that they had to have a cover up. They had to have a cover up because the country wasn't ready to take it on that we'd had a et tu Brute moment and we'd actually assassinated a president. Not to put too fine a point on it, but they forgot about we assassinated Abraham Lincoln. But there was a war then. And we've shot a few others too. As a matter of fact, T.R. Roosevelt, you know, Teddy Roosevelt wouldn't have become president even if he hadn't been working as vice president for a president who was shot and didn't think he was going to die, and then he did die. That was a real moment for Teddy. He was up on a mountain somewhere hunting or something, I forget what, and he rode his horse down, lickety split. You know, they had put him in the vice presidency to get him out of the political realm. Mark Hanna and the boys didn't like him at all, so they put him in the vice presidency. He said he'll die there. He'll die there. Now all of a sudden he's president. So lots of things can happen from assassinations that don't exactly produce the results that maybe the assassin intended. Although this looked like it was really just who it was, just an irritated immigrant who wanted to shoot the president. But again, there's a statement on the violence in this country. We shoot people. When we get into that fringe element that thinks they can change things all by themselves, if this was a lone shooter, we shoot people. We go into a discotheque or a restaurant, or we go into a party and we shoot people. We just shoot people and then go out and get ourselves shot. It's a phenomenon that disturbs a lot of people. And yet at the same time, I think a lot of people have an intuitive feeling about it. And they know that we are that kind of country. They don't like to admit it to themselves. They don't like to go back, for example, and say what we did to the Native Americans. They don't like what we did in the war with Mexico. They don't like what we did in a lot of times when we use violence, political violence in particular, but they accept it. And they accept it by looking beyond it. I was listening to, I think it was Scott Ritter with you. He was talking about how we get to the point that I think it was, who used this phrase the first time? Hannah Arendt, I believe she used this. The banality of evil. Or as Stalin said, you know, you can kill one person and you might go to jail. You might even hang. But if you kill a million, it's a statistic. Well, that's the way we are in America. We like to kill a lot of people.
Senator Rence, he's going to be the vice president of Donald Trump. How do you find Senator Rence when it comes to the policy, the foreign policy of the United States?
Well, first of all, here's a man who has done the standard thing that is lickspittle and indicates ambition par excellence. He denounced Donald Trump as a young man, as a young, I think he was a Marine, if I remember right. And he's running in Ohio, and you see him with no beard, and you know he's looking like a young guy, and he's saying all these nasty things about Donald Trump, and now he's saying all these great things. And I listened to a series of things that he said since he made his transformation, and they're just so obsequious. And so you've got to put at the forefront of your assessment of his character the same thing Julius Caesar supposedly said about that lean and hungry look that Cassius wore. Because this is a lean and hungry man, and he'll take the vice presidency, thank you very much, and he covets the presidency, and he sees a route to get there, and he does not care how he gets there. That's my interpretation of him at this moment. The second thing that bothers me about him is that he seems to be reasonably competent. And Trump needs to execute some of his plans, like Project 2025, someone he can turn to, as Powell turned to me, for example, go to the CIA and prepare my presentation at the UN on 5 February 2003. Are you kidding me, boss? You want me to go do that? Yeah. Well, that's the kind of guy I see Vance as for Trump. So look for him to be in charge of putting 2025 into action, or some project like that that will get him in the limelight, get his name recognized, and make him a viable candidate in the future, and maybe transform America, and not necessarily for the good. I wouldn't have said that about some of the other potential candidates, but this one I will, because that's the kind of person he seems like to me. Energetic to a fault.
Yeah. Larry, do you think if Trump wins the election 2024, is he going to release those documents on Kennedy's assassination?
Well, that would be a positive thing he could do. Funny thing, though, Trump does not seem to have a whole lot of respect for classified information, and that would make one think that he might have a propensity to do that. Plus, it would be a blow back at the system that I think he really detests. But I could see him being talked out of doing that by the powers that be. There is a closing of the ranks on both sides of the political aisle, and even both sides of the philosophical political aisle, about the Kennedy assassination. There are people who still think the Americans are not ready for the truth, that they can't accept the truth. When what I find across the country is most Americans have accepted the fact that their government had something to do with the assassination of their president. And they've just gone on from that point. Now, young people aren't that way. Young people, you know, they don't make a study of it. They weren't around when it happened, so they're not impacted by it in the way, for example, I was. But I think the majority of the American people would either ho-hum or not take it very well. And so why release it? Why let it out? That would probably be the advice Trump's advisors would give him, and it'd probably sit there for another 45 years or whatever. I think possible evidence of what really happened is the actual x-rays, which they've never released. What they did for the Warren Commission was make some drawings of them. And those drawings do not support what the initial autopsy in Dallas said. It supports what the subsequent autopsy at Walter Reed determined, which was all staged, I think.
In his first administration, he had a lot of neocons just controlling everything. Do you think that Trump gonna be able just not letting these people getting into the administration, or he's not going to be able to control that?
I see two possibilities. The first time around, you left out Mike Flynn. You left out a host of H.R. McMaster, as far as I'm concerned, not necessarily branded as a neocon, but very much like a neocon. And for that matter, Jim Mattis. Jim Mattis never met anybody he didn't want to kill in real terms. And I don't say that because I'm accusing him of being a killer. I'm accusing him of being a typical Marine working for the United States of America. That's what I'm saying. And you made him Secretary of Defense. Thank you very much. And he also had his fingers in the defense complex, money on those fingers. So he made some bad choices, in my view. Are the neocons clever enough to sneak back into his administration? Absolutely. And will they? Probably, but not to the extent, I don't think, that they might think they would, because he's got an entourage now that is very much aware of how not only others that they detest corrupted his first administration, including John Bolton, but how that happened and how to prevent it now. And that's part, not part of 2025, but it's the same idea that you only take people in who are with you 100%. And the way you guarantee that is you give them all sorts of, you know, prizes to do it. You give them access to things they wouldn't have access to otherwise, and you give them power they wouldn't have otherwise. But you watch them very closely, and you put an entourage of intermediate staff that watches them even more closely. And so that way you assure, and this is, I think, Trump's great goal this time, you assure that other than one or two people that you might not calculate properly about, everyone's working for you. Everyone's working on your policy sheet, on your policy diagram, and for you, and might not be beloved of you, but certainly would kiss your boot or whatever. That's going to be a first priority with him, I think, if he's in there again. And that's going to eliminate a lot of these people, I think. That said, I still think his attention to detail is so flawed and so flagrantly dispersed by whatever happens to come along that might amuse him at the moment, that there are going to be people who will be operating on their own agendas and doing their own thing. And I think that is probably, as I said about the first administration, with respect to Cuba in particular, and it certainly happened in spades, that you need to just lie low and don't get in his bomb sight, you know, don't attract attention. The other possibility, I said to the Cubans, is that there will be people he'll bring into the administration, and this happened, who will take his inattention to Cuba and run with it. And they did. They just about reversed everything President Obama had done that was positive. Did the same thing with the Iranian deal, but that was a little bit bigger and had to get up actually to Trump making a decision. And a couple of other things were that way too. But they were successful in convincing him to make that decision. I think that's going to be more difficult this time around, to convince him to make decisions that he might be opposed to from either a personal or in terms of his own conception of what he ought to do and ought not to do reason. He's going to be a different president, I think. And that could be bad. It could be good. I tend to come down on the side of it could be bad. But I don't know. I simply don't know. There are enough people around him now who are traditional Republicans who seem to think that they can control him, or that he is not necessarily to be controlled by them, but he's thinking so much on an agenda that they agree with that they can live with him. And I have to think that there's some reason for that. I don't see it. I don't know it. I don't feel it. But I have to believe that there's some reason why there are some really polished politicians in the Republican Party who are willing to go along with Trump. The other conclusion I have to come to is that they don't care so long as he accomplishes two or three of their major purposes. Like, for example, the Right to Life group and abortion. They got the repeal of Roe v. Wade, in essence. And they're looking for, many of them are looking for that kind of action on other issues, prayer in the classroom, for example. Louisiana's already done that, as I understand it. And we're waiting, you know, to see what this court will do with it. But those kind of issues, I think, are make or break issues with his crowd. And he's going to take those issues on, and he's going to make the decision that they want him to make. That could be dangerous. But at the same time, I can see the political prospects for his doing that and enhancing the power of the Republican Party in a way that no one expected it to be enhanced, because that's what the majority of the American people want. I hope I'm wrong, but I could see that happening, particularly in the evangelical Christian national Christian nationalism arena. I could even see that there would be, I'd say at the third year, maybe the final year of Trump's second term in office, if that's the end of it, and that's what I fear. I could see that Christianity might be made a national religion by fiat, by executive order, or even the Congress passing some sort of legislation to that effect and making us another European country that we revolted against in 1776. You know, I could see that happening. I hate to say that, but I could see that happening because I understand the power that these evangelicals and others like them have in the country now, and the power and the hold that Christianity has over a good 51, 52% of the American people.
What is the outcome of this shooting at Donald Trump on the Democratic Party, and how is that going to influence the Democratic Party and Joe Biden?
Well, you've already seen that it made Joe Biden go out and tell a passel of lies. If it's not a passel of lies, he's living on a different planet, as I said. But if it has the tendency that Biden wanted it to have, the effect that he wanted it to have, and calms some of these people down, then that's a positive, I think. Maybe we, you know, turn off the violence for a little while. I don't see how that happens, though, with us exporting violence at the volumes that we are with regard to Ukraine and Gaza. People think that that's some psychologist's theory or something, that if you're excessively violent in your foreign policy, your security policy, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to transmogrify into your domestic environment. I think that's absolutely the case. If you're violent overseas, you're going to be violent domestically, and the violence is going to breed violence and so on. Martin Luther King was very eloquent on that point. All violence breeds is more violence. All violence breeds is hatred. All hatred breeds is more violence, and so forth. A never ending loop until you've, you know, done maximum damage to yourself. I think we're in one of those never ending loops right now where violence is permeating all manner of walks of our life. And there are people who actually began to think that they live for that violence, not just soldiers, Marines, and airmen and such, but people who are on the cusp a lot of the time. You know, should I really take action here? Should I really do something violent? I'm still waiting, for example, to hear clarification of what happened at that Javelin plant in Arkansas. You know, we had an ammunition plant in Arkansas that had an accident, supposedly, and blew up. Well, it happened to be Javelin missiles. Well, where do Javelin missiles go? They go to Ukraine. Who did that? And why did they do it? Or was it truly an accident? There's no clarifying comment on it right now. And as far as the press is concerned, it was just an episode and it went away. I read Ali Sufan's reports pretty regularly, and Ali says we've got a lot of problems in this country, and we've got a lot of people who want to effect a terrorist act in this country, either domestic people, that is to say Americans, or people who come across the borders and are in this country and belong to ISIS or belong to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's resurgent now, particularly in Yemen. And the most powerful element of Al-Qaeda is in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, according to Ali, and he knows Al-Qaeda better than anyone I know. And so are we going to have more of that? Are we going to have more terrorist acts within this country? And then the question for me is, if he is elected, if Donald Trump is elected, what does he do about that? Does that give him an automatic right into totalitarianism? Does that give him an automatic right to suspend the regular operations of government and become a dictator? I could see Trump doing that. So I don't think the future is bright right now for the United States. I think it's very dim. And as you know, I've said there are three things right now that truly indicate the evening of empire, if you will. One, and standing out prominently and with very little attention in the Congress, an occasional word here and there, is our colossal debt, $50.7 trillion by 2034. Interest payments on that debt to equal Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and the defense budget combined, or you default on your debt. So that debt is hanging over every American's heads, and worse, most of them don't know it, don't realize it. Corporate and private debt is in similar straits. That's the first problem. Second problem is our overextension, gross overextension with inadequate means to support that overextension. And I mean Ukraine and potentially Russia, and that really makes it overextension, and Gaza and potentially Hezbollah, and that really makes it overextension. It deepens the crisis we're in. And then the third thing is lack of leadership. Colossal lack of leadership. I think it's fair to say, and listen, we've had some really poor presidents in our some 200 plus years, but we've had them at times that we could tolerate them. We've had them at times that nothing much was going on that needed a very dynamic and careful and even charismatic and welcome with the American people president to do things. We're not at that stage anymore. We're at a stage where we need really dynamic, competent leadership. I do not see it on the horizon in the Congress or in the executive branch. And we know what we've got in the Supreme Court. We've got six or seven lackeys of corporate America in the Supreme Court and Christian America in the Supreme Court, particularly Catholic Christian America. So we've lost the three pillars of government at a time when we need leadership worse than probably any time in our history, except perhaps the Civil War period. That's a recipe for, and in the Civil War, no matter what we did in the North or the South did for itself in terms of monetary policy and money, we were not nearly in debt as we are now. I would say, given World War I and all the money we made, and World War II and the way we recovered from that by turning on, as Putin's doing now, the productive mechanism of, as Yamamoto said, a fearful tiger filled with resolve, we just don't have that today. We do not have it. And we're overextended, we're overspent, and we're lacking leadership, and we don't have anything to back up what we are doing. That's a recipe for imperial decline, not on a gradual glide slope, but collapse. My question, and we're going to have a Zoom tomorrow, and I'm going to ask this question, what's it going to look like? What's it going to look like? I probably will be dead, but maybe not. You know, CBO's estimate of $50.7 trillion in 2034, CBO has been characteristically low on their estimates. Debt has built up faster than the CBO has predicted, although they've been very pessimistic in that regard. Would it happen sooner? If a lack of confidence struck the American people on a large scale basis, it could happen much sooner. It could happen in 2028, 2029. I might still be here then. I'm not eager to be here when that happens, because I think it's going to be worse than any depression, recession, economic hiccup, bout of capitalistic fury that we've ever had in our national life. And I'm not sure we can take it.
How do you find, Larry, the conflict in Ukraine?
I think it's a disaster. And I don't see any relief from that disaster. I see it deepening and becoming even more profound until we have the elections in this country. I don't see how we work ourselves out of it, because Biden has no inclination whatsoever, and his lackeys are following his lead pretty closely on this. And I hate to say this, I include Bill Burns in that now. The only person in the administration, the only person in this administration for whom I have respect as a diplomat and as a human being. But I've seen, I have to admit up front that I've not seen him in Qatar or other places like that doing exquisite negotiations that might be taking place right now. But I just think he's malplaced, entirely malplaced, being at the agency. I don't see any competence, Nima. I simply don't see any competence. And I see this idea that what Biden is saying has to not be contradicted in a major way. Ukraine is going to win. Ukraine is, what was it Blinken said? We've lit a road for Ukraine's membership in NATO. That's not going to change until he's lost, until Biden has lost the election. I don't know that it's going to change majorly with Donald Trump, but I have a suspicion that it is. So we're hooked. We're hooked on the same dilemma that we usually are when it comes to domestic politics and it impacts on security and foreign policy, because the impacts are normally not good and you have to get through them and get a change in administration or get a change in the lookout or the overview of the existing administration if it's returned to office, and a relief from having to be reelected again before you can get a change in policy that makes a difference. It's sad to say. I think we sent 50,000 boys. It was all boys then. Well, there were some nurses that were wounded or killed, female nurses. But we sent those boys to Vietnam, and LBJ had no qualms about saying, oh, Ho ain't going to be moved by no bombs, to the Air Force. And he knew damn well George Ball was right, that there was no way we were going to win in Vietnam. But he knew that if he wanted his great society and he wanted the American people on his side throughout all the legislation, difficult legislation he needed to achieve for that, and he achieved quite a bit domestically, that he couldn't cut and run from Vietnam. So 50,000 more people died. That's another thing that bothers me. We have this totally blasé attitude now because of the all-volunteer force. You know, one person, some in the government, summed it up this way. Well, they're volunteer, didn't they? You know, when someone commented to him about all the people dying in Iraq, he said, well, they volunteered, didn't they? All the people dying in Afghanistan, well, they volunteered, didn't they? Okay, yeah, well, is that the real way you feel about it? Yeah, it is. They're expendable, just as the Palestinians are expendable and the Ukrainians are expendable, as long as we think we're achieving our foreign policy goals. The idiocy, Nima, the idiocy of this is we aren't achieving our foreign policy goals. We're defeating any sane goals. We're defeating any positive goals, whatever goals they have up there. You know, I told you the other day, I think I have discovered that the two conflicting objectives here that everyone has set for themselves prior to the election is no war of NATO with Russia, and Ukraine doesn't lose. So you're going to get to November with those two objectives, and you're not going to fall off of them at all until after November? I was listening to Putin this morning. I think it was yesterday, but this morning was when I was listening to it. And he was talking about prisoner exchanges. And again, how willing he is to talk, how ready he is to talk. Apparently, we're not even willing to talk to him about that, a matter like that, a humanitarian matter like that, which we ought to be willing to talk to tomorrow morning, if necessary, for prisoner exchanges. And you can't tell me that Putin is putting up some kind of ungodly condition on prisoner exchanges. I mean, that's pretty simple. And you don't want to shoot down his airplane when he's sending your prisoners back to you, like the Ukrainians did.
Yeah. But it doesn't seem that the Biden administration right now, with the current situation that they're having, with the current position of their administration in the United States, it doesn't seem that they're considering any sort of negotiations in Ukraine.
No, and this recent occasion for him to come out, Biden to come out for what, the third or maybe fourth time in his entire administration, which is coming to an end, and give an address to the American people. We know why now, I think, after watching the debates. It makes me think that we're stuck now on the fascination with the assassination attempt, and that all the other things that we should be and should have been a long time ago talking about a change in policy with regard to, like, Gaza. Nima Gaza is, I mean, Israel's falling apart. From everything I'm hearing, Israel's falling apart. They are falling apart. They're being defeated. They're being beaten by Hamas. And if they go against Hezbollah without us, they're going to be beaten badly by Hezbollah. Where are they going to be after that? I got a casualty report recently for the IDF and blew me away, both wounded and killed. I think I mentioned to you the other day, or maybe it was some other interview, when the Wehrmacht went into Russia, Operation Barbarossa, June 1941, they sliced through Ukraine and into Russia pretty rapidly, but it cost them 400,000 soldiers. Now, they went in with roughly 3.8, 3.9, 4 million. Military doctrine, and civilians are often shocked by this, essentially says if you lose 10% of your combat troops, you become combat ineffective. Well, that was 10%. So if you study the Wehrmacht from the point where they didn't get the Ukrainian crops that they thought they were going to get, they got some of them, that's the way they subsisted, but not as well as they thought they would. And they weren't able to send a lot of that food back to Germany to keep Germany from being submarine, you know, blockade, starving to death. So it went to hell quickly. By the time they get to Stalingrad, they are essentially beaten already. And it just remains for Stalingrad to be the stopping point and the turnaround point, and they get pursued all the way back to Berlin, of course. Brilliantly fighting a withdrawal, but one of the most difficult military operations, a withdrawal under pressure. And they do that brilliantly and take a lot of Soviet debt, you know, make a lot of Soviet soldiers die. But at the same time, they've lost. They've lost that point in the war. They have lost against the other empire they're fighting in that direction, the Soviet Union. Israel's lost. They have lost. And they've lost in such a significant way that you have to come back and blame Netanyahu for it, because he went into this knowing full well that he was going to do what he was going to do, pursuing it relentlessly, having assembled a government that would support him and even egg him on to do more and more in regard to what he wanted to do. And he has destroyed his own military. And if he turns and goes against Hezbollah, which I fully expect to happen, he'll seal the deal with the U.S. on the 24th of July when he comes here. He'll talk to people like Josh Hawley and Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer, and he'll get assurances that the United States will put its battle forces in the Eastern Mediterranean and back him up 100%. So he'll go after Hezbollah. Then we'll see what Turkey does. We'll see what Cyprus does. We'll see what all the rest of the players in the region do who are sick and tired of Bibi Netanyahu and sick and tired of the killing and sick and tired of the entire image that this zealous Zionism has suddenly painted Israel with. We're not in good shape, Nima. We're not in good shape at all. Ukraine, we're going to stick with it to the election, which is just, in my view, stupid, insane. And we're going to stick with Israel until Israel collapses. What are we going to do then? What's our plan B? What's our plan for resurrecting Israel? It won't be enough to just put a whole lot of U.S. forces over there and say, come back, you Israelis who left, because they're leaving. They're leaving in large numbers now. And I don't blame them. They went there in the first place, the second place, the third place for security. They went there to be secure and to be economically successful. Well, he gave them the economic success for a long period of time and lulled them into apathy. Now they're getting the insecurity. And the insecurity, to me, looks like it might continue for some time. And Netanyahu likes it because he doesn't go to jail. He stays in power and he doesn't go to jail. I don't think the average Israeli is liking it too much. And they're going to start voting with their feet. They're going to start leaving.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us. The great pleasure, as always.
Well, it's been an interesting conversation. I wish there were something more positive I could say, especially about my own state, but I really think we're in some deep water right now. The physical situation, Ukraine, Gaza. They're talking about a parliament now, the BRICS. They're talking about putting something together like the EU parliament,
Yeah.
Don't blame them. I don't blame them a bit. And I would expect there to be more forays into the Western Hemisphere by both Russia and China. And we've expedited that. We've given them incentive to do that, not just for, look what we can do. You can do it. We can do it too. But they have had probably a lot of this on hold for other reasons, economic, financial, and what the United States might do to them in those two sectors. Were they to really get angry with violations of the Monroe Doctrine. But now they don't care. They don't care. We have removed their care. So we can look for more of this, and we'll have to hope that Ottawa and Mexico City at least hold to their guns in terms of no Russian or Chinese fortifications on their territory. But 10 years from now, 10 years from now, I don't know. I don't know. If we keep pursuing the kind of stupid policies we're pursuing now, I could see Mexico and Canada being other than friendly. You've got to go your own route in the world eventually if you're being led down a hellhole.